Well, 1 Samuel 18, in our study of the life of Saul, we looked at that last week and we sort of saw a character study in jealousy. I commented last week, I don't know if you've ever heard a sermon just devoted to jealousy. Maybe you have. I don't say we need to hear one every week. But it is a subject that I think is more around than maybe we concede that it is, just because jealousy is one of those sins of the spirit, and we don't hear so much about that, but those kinds of things seem to be around and just as prevalent, really, as the sins of the flesh, and maybe even in a more serious way. This week, we move forward, plunging a little deeper into Saul and all of his problems. I remind you again that I realize that a lot of this is learning by negative example, but so much of what we see is fearful that it opens our eyes, and if nothing else, it says to us, you know, I don't want to go there. And this morning's message is similar to that. If last week we had a case study in jealousy, this week we have something of a case study in chastening. Well, you have seen it because the scripture was read in your hearing. Ugliness, hatred erupt again almost immediately on the coattails of chapter 18. Saul renews his efforts to murder David. And why? Well, let's repeat something that we've seen a number of times in this series. Because he has sin in his heart that he ignores, refuses to deal with, refuses to admit. And I just remind you again as we see this, I can't think of a better illustration to make this point than a snowball, because everyone knows that the farther it goes down the mountain, the bigger it gets and the harder it is to stop. And that's the way sin is. That's an electrifying, that's a scary message to realize. Sin has that power. Beloved, I'm convinced we're living in a day where sin is downgraded, you know, so is God's holiness. It's all Christianity light. And we don't hear very much about this. And so sin is kind of downplayed. Sin's nothing to mess with. Sin's destructive. Sin is powerful, just as a snowball is. And if nothing else this morning, one of the things that we need to recognize is, you know, if God is speaking to my heart along the lines of any of these things that we're talking about, I must come to grips with this. I must go to someone if I need help. I must make this right. I must deal with this. Because if you let that thing go, sooner or later there's going to be some kind of an explosion. It's not going to be pleasant. And you can't avoid seeing that in the life of Saul. And this chapter today just moves us forward because it's exactly what happens. It's coming more and more to a head. God is going to deal with this man. In fact, in this story, what we find is the record of God intervening. Now, if we were doing a series on the life of David, I would point out that God is intervening on David's half in terms of protecting him. Here's a man whose hand God is on. Here's a man anointed. Here's the man who's to be Saul's successor as king of the nation of Israel. What is God going to do when you've got a fool sitting there, a man who's paranoid, a man who's schizophrenic, with a javelin in his lap? Did you read that? Or did you listen to that when that was read in our hearing this morning? That's scary, really. I mean, here is David. I don't know if he was armed, but he's basically playing a harp or some instrument like this, trying to calm this man. And Saul has a javelin in his hand. It's about like a man sitting there with an AR-15 on his lap, with a 30-round clip. And then you say, whoa, I hope he's got the safety on that thing. I hope there's no round in the chamber. But since he's already tried before, I'm a little nervous that he's sitting there and got it. That's the way this is. God intervenes on David's behalf to protect him. But God is intervening here in the life of Saul. He's intervening to restrain him. He's intervening to chasten him. Depends how you look at it. If you think Saul is truly belonging to the Lord as a child of the Lord, I'm not saying which way. He's intervening to chasten him. If you think he's not a child of the Lord, he's intervening to judge him. But in reality, chastening is a form of God's judgment anyway, so I hope we can be on the same page with that. Here's sort of the takeaway I'd like to have you think about with me this morning. You know, God's chastening is very real and it's very frightful. This is sort of what I've tried to magnify in the introduction to the sermon. Just as sin is very real and very frightful, if we let sin go in our lives and God has to take a dealing with that because we refuse to, I'm pointing out from the message this morning that that is frightful and it is real. Do not be deceived. Doesn't the Bible tell us this over and over again? Do not be deceived by thinking you can look the other way, that you can ignore sin in your life, that you can just figure, well, everyone does it, it'll go away. No. If God is dealing with you, if God is pointing out things that need to be taken care of, if you ignore that, God will in love intervene in your life. God will in love bring His chastening hand upon you. For whom the Lord loveth, He chasteneth and scourgeth every son, every child whom He receives. And I end my introduction by reminding you of Hebrews 10:31. It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. How many people here this morning fear God? You have to put your hand up. I mean, really, how many people here this morning fear God? I wish I feared Him more, but I'm plenty afraid. And when I don't love Him like I should, and my love for Him is not strong enough to keep me from things that are wrong, that fear oftentimes kicks in and keeps me... I'm not going there. Well, I've not seen too many other people do that. I've seen what happens. I'm not going there. And I think to myself, you know, Coleman, it's not because you're so noble. It's not because you've grown so much in grace. You're just afraid. Yeah, I am afraid. I'm not a part of the generation that says no fear. There are two examples that magnify this takeaway point. That God's chastening is very real, that it's very fearful, frightful. But before I reveal those to you, may I say, these two are by no means God's only or exclusive tools. If I can put it this way and it not sound bad to you, it not sound like I'm making God out to be some mean ogre, I'm simply saying God knows how to get to all of us. And He may not use these particular things in your life, the two that we're going to see here this morning with Saul that illustrate this idea. Chastening is very frightful. It's very real. But if not, He has other mechanisms and other ways. Let's think about this for a moment. Never losing sight of the fact that if this happens to us, it doesn't happen because God is mean. It doesn't happen because what I'm portraying to you this morning is some kind of a God who's unkind. No, God just knows what I've been trying to say, and sometimes I forget and you forget. Sin is that bad that God is going to deal with us because He knows in love if He doesn't, a worse problem is coming. Not to mention the fact that God saved us and called us with an holy calling and wants to conform us to the image of His Son. It's a smoother ride if you realize that and cooperate rather than resist. The first thing that we're going to talk about this morning, the first tool that God uses to intervene in Saul's life, to restrain him, to chasten him, I'm going to call it frustration. How many people here have been frustrated by something this week? Oh, come on, you can be more honest than that. I thought so. How many people here this morning have been frustrated by a number of things this week? How many people are easily frustrated? Yeah, well, okay, so what I'm talking about, I need to clarify this morning. What I'm talking about is not just part of the... I mean, there is frustration in this world, period, as a result of sin, right? It just kind of comes in a fallen world. You say, oh, I'm so glad to know that. Because if you've been frustrated this week, I'm not trying to say, okay, God is chastening you. He might be, but I got to distinguish the kinds of frustrations we're talking about. The writer of Ecclesiastes, what does he say over and over again? He talks about the fact that all is vain and striving after wind. Right? Over and over again, he tells us this, that there's a vanity, that there's a futility in this world. And that striving after wind, how does the King James put it? It just left me. You got it? Anybody? Vanity of spirit, whatever he calls it. His little phrase there is the idea of striving after wind. Well, that's frustrating, isn't it? You can't catch the wind. I was reading about a woman, and she was in a busy grocery store. So I think a lot of people can identify with this, woman or not. You're in a busy grocery store. It might be Walmart. It might be Giant, but it's a busy time. And she was there with her toddler named Susie. And Susie was doing what toddlers will sometimes do. She was pitching a fit, flailing her arms, yelling in the store. Her mother was seen by a number of people muttering, but she could be heard to say things like, well, the toddler's name wasn't Susie, so sorry. But she was heard to be saying things like, Susie, calm down. Susie, don't be excited. Susie, don't yell. And at one point, she passed a lady who said to her, you know, you seem to be doing such a wonderful job with your child, trying to keep your child calm. She said, lady, she said, I'm not trying to keep her calm. She said, she's not Susie, I am. How many people here this morning do that? You know, you just kind of draw yourself up short and try to keep saying to yourself, don't lose it. Don't lose it. Don't lose it. Don't say something you shouldn't say. Yep, there's some frustration that's in this world. It really is. And that's just sort of the general problems that tend to be around. I'm not talking about that. I'm going to shift the illustration and tell you what I am talking about. I'm talking about when God deliberately gets in your way and starts messing things up. Can I put it that way? Do you remember? So here's a different story. Do you remember the story of Balaam? Do you remember when he decided he was going to go over there and start working with Balak, and God really didn't want him to do that? But because he was so determined he should do that and wanted to do it anyway, God said, well, go ahead. You know, sometimes that happens with people. It happens with kids, and parents sometimes have to recognize this. And it happens with God's children, and God recognizes it. Sometimes you just have to tell them, okay, go break your leg. Go stub your toe. But he's out of God's will, and there he is on this donkey. Now remember, the donkey had been his faithful servant for life. And he's going along, and the first thing happens is the donkey sees something that Balaam doesn't see. What does he see? He sees the angel of the Lord in front of him with a drawn sword. So what does he do? The donkey turns aside off the road, goes out into the field. Would that frustrate you? It frustrated him. He struck the thing. So they get back in the road and continue the journey. This time, they get to a place where it's like this aisle. It's narrow. There's a wall or something, the Bible says, on either side. And once again, the donkey sees the angel of the Lord in front with a drawn sword. What does the donkey do? He goes over here and kiboshes right into the side, Balaam's leg and foot. That felt real good. Would that frustrate you? Frustrated Balaam, he struck the thing again. So they get back on the trip, and the donkey's going down the road again, and guess what? Once again, the donkey sees the angel of the Lord with a sword in his hand. What does he do? He just says, I've had it with this. This is the donkey. And he just kneels down and quits. Balaam gets so mad, he gets so angry, he gets so frustrated, he takes his staff, he strikes that thing the third time. And God opened the mouth of the donkey who spoke to him. And Balaam was so angry that he didn't even realize that something supernatural had occurred and started talking back to the donkey. Now, this is the kind of frustration that I'm talking about here. This is God's deliberate intervention in your life. And I used kind of a vernacular expression a moment ago to kind of mess things up for you. Everything doesn't seem to be going well at all. It seems to be going wrong. I just keep having problem after problem after problem. I get angry. I get frustrated, like Balaam with this donkey. I lash out at people. I'm upset. Now maybe we should consider that God, is God in this? He was in this with Saul. How do we see this in the story? Kind of have to be brief because there are actually four examples of it. In the first part of the chapter, moving down almost really to the very end, I want to save the last verse really to make the last point, the second of the two methods God is using here. So he intervenes. Okay, don't lose me. He intervenes in Saul's life to restrain him, to chasten him. He uses now this method of frustration, and there are four vehicles or people, whatever, who are involved in this. In the first seven verses, it's Jonathan, his son. So, what happens? Well, Jonathan is David's friend. He says, somehow he is able to effect reconciliation once again between Saul and his father, and Saul's purpose to kill David sort of comes to an end there, as the Bible tells us that David is restored to the presence of Saul and things seem to be as they were before. So that's vehicle number one. Vehicle number two we find in verse number 9, where it says, "And the evil spirit from the Lord was upon Saul." Stop for just a moment on this one. Has that ever raised a question in your mind? The evil spirit from the Lord was upon Saul. Well, I don't know that I can totally solve this one for you, because there are certainly interpreters who take either position on this. There are interpreters who believe that this was some type of demonic spirit. Well, I can't solve it, but there is another valid interpretation, and perhaps this one might be a little more comfortable to you. And if we're wrong about this, then when we get to heaven, we'll be able to reconcile what seems to be an odd situation. But it all hinges on this word that's translated evil, which, by the way, we see this going back to all the way to chapter 16, when David first played for Saul, and the Lord, spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord came on him. But we're told in verse 23, it came to pass when the evil spirit from God was upon Saul. This is chapter 16, verse 23. That David took an harp and played with his hand. So Saul was refreshed and was well, and the evil spirit departed from him. It has to do with this Hebrew word. And I know sometimes when we get to difficult verses in the Bible, it often seems like the preacher or the commentator seems to be able to find help for us in a word. And maybe you get the impression sometimes that that's a cop-out. It really isn't, because languages and bringing concepts over from one language to another can sometimes be difficult. But yet I'd like to give you an illustration this morning that I think will show you this is not subterfuge, this is not sleight of hand in any way. Think about the word evil. Does it always have a moral connotation to it? Think about the word bad. Let's change it to bad. Does it always have a moral connotation to it? And the answer to that is no. And the same thing is true. This word in the original language of Hebrew that is translated evil is a well-known word in the Old Testament that runs the gamut, really, all the way from this side of the building to this side of the building. This side maybe where you have moral evil, and this side over here where you don't. Let me illustrate in English with the word bad. If you drive by HCI Huntington, or the SCI Huntington, sorry, someone, if you're giving a tour of the town, someone may make the comment that, oh, well, this is one of the prisons in our town, one of the main attractions. And someone may say, well, oh, wow, I see all that razor wire and trucks patrolling, and is that a maximum security prison? And you say, well, that's some really bad people in there. Moral connotation to the word? Yes. If you go home after church and no one has thought what you're having for dinner, or you're having must go. You remember when Mrs. Lynch was here and gave us that pearl of wisdom? Having must go. What's must go? Well, it's all that stuff in the refrigerator that must go. We're having must go. So we're getting out all the things that must go, and you pull the lid off one and it's got stuff growing on it. He said, I'm not having that for dinner today because it's gone bad. Moral connotation? No. See, the word's just flexible. That's the word you have here. So without giving other illustrations, you know, the one that always makes me laugh is when you go to Jeremiah chapter 22 and Jeremiah has the vision of the figs. Anybody remember this one? You can read this later in verses 3 and 4, but Jeremiah has a vision of figs. And he says he has some good figs. It's kind of like Pharaoh's cattle in the dream, which, by the way, is another illustration of this. That word evil is translated ill-favored there because the cattle weren't morally evil. They just weren't good. So it's translated ill-favored. But when Jeremiah sees the vision of the figs, he talks about the fact that some figs were good and some figs were evil. It's our same word here. What's he mean? Well, he also says that the figs that were evil, they were naughty. In fact, he says they were very naughty. I always laugh when I read that because we don't use that word quite in that way today, but it does sort of focus us on the point that, and this is why, okay, when you take this information and bring it into this matter of interpretation with this second vehicle that he's using to frustrate this evil spirit, you will find that the New King James, for instance, translates distressing spirit. The English Standard Version translates harmful spirit. So whether this is demonic or whether this is just a spirit that's sent to frustrate Saul, to mess up things for Saul, any way you cut it, here's the bottom line. It made things miserable for him. Right? Because when we read that back in chapter 16, he was so goofed up. I mean, he was goofed up emotionally. He was goofed up physically. He was goofed up spiritually. And David came in and would play and he'd get relief from that. I mean, this, whatever it was, had the capacity just to make his life miserable. Do you want to go there? I got enough problems without God having to try to get my attention by making things in my life miserable, don't you? I don't need that. But there's a third mechanism, and that's Michal. As Tom was reading that, of course, that's Saul's daughter who was given to David in marriage. Saul explodes. As soon as you read in verse number 8, there's war again with the Philistines. What happens? David goes out to battle. It incites that old flame of jealousy. And the evil spirit is once again upon Saul, and he once again tries to kill David. He sends down there to the house where David and Michal are. His messengers come back and say, he's sick. Saul says, I don't care if he's sick or not. Get back down there and haul him up here in the bed for me to kill him. This guy's bad off. And Michal says to her husband, remember she loved him. The Bible tells us this. She said to her husband, if you don't get out of here tonight in the morning, you won't save your life. She lets him down in a window and he's gone. I don't know what kind of hair David had. I just know the Bible says he was handsome. But when it says that she took goat's hair for his bolster, the word bolster is his head. So when they looked there and they saw some goat's hair, I'm not sure. It doesn't sound. But did he have curly hair? I don't know. But that was kind of the ruse that was used. He's frustrated again. He can't seem to pull this thing off. He wants to kill this man. And here is God intervening to frustrate him and protect David at the same time. He first of all intervenes through his son Jonathan. He then intervenes through this harmful, distressing spirit. He then intervenes through his daughter Michal. His efforts are once again frustrated. He's really at the tipping point. So now he hears, and here's the fourth one. Now he hears that, well, he's gone now. He escaped. Well, where'd he go? He went to Samuel. Talking about in Sunday school needing a friend. I mean, he really needed a friend at this point, and he couldn't stay close to Jonathan, so he went to Samuel. I can hear this now. You got me into this! And he's with Samuel in Naioth of Ramah. And so Saul finds out where he is. He sends messengers. Did you catch this in the story? How many times did he send messengers? 3 times. And what happens in each of the 3 times? These messengers come, they're in the presence of Samuel and the prophets, and the Spirit of God overwhelms them, and they start prophesying. And I can see it now. Saul's saying to them, what is the problem with you people? What do I have, a bunch of idiots working for me? So he sends another team down. Same thing happens to them. He sends a third team down. Same thing happens to them. You think he's frustrated at this point? I think he's really frustrated. He is so frustrated that he says, you bunch of nincompoops, you have to do a job right. You want a job done right, you do it yourself. So he gets his javelin and he says, I'll go take care of it myself. Woo. You know, I would want to work with that guy. a bad situation to be involved in when you've got somebody like this. But see, God is dealing with him. That's what's going on. And before I leave this and just talk briefly about the last point, I simply want to say, I think there's something that we can, there's an ascending order in this, okay? It keeps getting more. There's Jonathan. The distressing spirit is more. Michael being his daughter, I think maybe is even a little bit more. But this last thing, when he's in the presence of the man of God and the prophets, and he is shut down at that point, and it becomes very clear, this is the most overt evidence, I think, at this point, that God is in this. God is the one who's bringing this frustration. God is the one who's restraining him. Why? Because he's out of God's will. He knows this. We pointed this out in the message last week. There's no doubt in his mind at this point that he's operating outside the will of God. It's the whole reason he wants to kill David, is because he knows David is a threat to him, and he knows he no longer rightfully occupies the throne of the nation of Israel, that it's been given to a man who, after God's own heart, it's been given to his neighbor, a man who is better than he. And he at this point deeply suspects, if does not know, that this man is David. Why he's trying to kill him. I only have this thought before I have to get out of here. I've spent too much long time already. I get from this something that I think is a good principle to take with me, with you in life, that when you find the people closest to you who love you, it may not always be family, it may be, but when you find the people closest to you who know you, who love you, and when on top of that you find the spiritual people leadership in your life, that's what you have here. You have the people who really know him and love him. Not too many people are going to know him any better than Jonathan and his daughter. And you have the man of God in the person of Samuel and these prophets. And when you've got people like that who are concerned about what you're doing, the course of action that you're taking, when you have people like that, it's time to stop and take stock. God is very likely trying to use those people to break through maybe what's become a hardened exterior, maybe even what's become a hardened heart, and get your attention and touch your heart. You know, and you have to see it. You have to see it not as God's malevolence or unkindness. You have to see it as God's love. There's a doctor, his name is Richard Selzer. He's written a book called Mortal Lessons, Notes on the Art of Surgery. He tells a very interesting story in that book. He tells a story of a young woman. It was actually a young couple, but the patient was the young wife. She had some type of a tumor here in her left cheek. So he operated on her, and in the aftermath of the operation, he was there in the room. The young husband was there in the room. Obviously, she was. And in the course of this surgery, he had no choice, had to take the tumor out. But in the course of it, had no choice, there was a nerve that had been severed in the surgery. Left her mouth with kind of a distorted, she couldn't quite keep her lips the way they normally would be, and she had kind of a contorted, kind of a almost like a clownish look to her lips. So there they were, and the doctor's there by the bedside, and the young woman looks up to him and she says, "Will my mouth always be this way?" He said, "Yes, ma'am, I'm afraid so." He said, "I had no choice. In removing this tumor," he said, "that nerve was cut." And he said, "I'm afraid your mouth is going to be that way. There's nothing I can do about that." At that point, her young husband came over to her, stood over her, looked down at her and said, "I kind of like it. It's cute." And then he stooped over, bowed down, moved his own lips in such a way that they matched hers, and kissed her to let her know that the kiss still worked. The doctor's language was rather interesting. He, in the story, he says, "What could I do but bow my head in the presence of a God?" Beloved, what am I trying to say with this story? I'm saying you and I must never doubt God's love. My whole point is God's chastening is frightful. It's very real. Sometimes God has to deal in tough love. That's why I say it's a smoother road not to resist God. Not to get to the place in your life that Saul is. But you must never doubt God's love. If he has to sever a nerve, it's because he has a tumor to remove. Kind of scary thought, right? Better not to go there. Better not to have to go there. But at least it reminds us. See, what is the second thing about which we can talk for only a few minutes? In God's tool bag for this particular man at this particular juncture in his life, God's chastening, intervening to restrain this man, to punish him, if you will, to chasten him. He first uses frustration. Boy, I'll tell you, that scares me. That just scares me. I don't want that. I don't need that. You don't either. I mean, the older you get, I'm just going to tell you so you can listen to me and know that it's true. And there's people here older than I am, and I'll guarantee you, they'll tell you this is true. You know, you start out life, and sometimes you're not afraid of a fight. But that can be a good thing. But sometimes if you're not careful, you're spoiling for one. And the older you get, the more you realize, you know, I don't need it. I don't need it. Does it make it all go away? No, there's some you still have to do. Can't turn your back on it. Because some things are worth taking a stand for. Some things are worth fighting for. But you learn along the way to choose your battles very carefully. Because you only have so much strength. And because peace is a commodity that's precious. Don't need that. Need that. Don't need misery. Don't need frustration in my life. But there is something else that's here, and this one is things are going to get worse. Okay, for a few moments in the message, things are going to get worse. Why? Well, think about it for a moment. He sends four instruments to get this man's attention. He responds to none of them. How do we know he responds to none of them? Because he says, "I'm going myself to kill him." So now you're at verse 24. And what do we find? Humiliation. And verse 23, "And he went thither to Naioth and Ramah, and the Spirit of God was upon him also," not just the three teams that he sent. "And he went on and prophesied until he came to Naioth and Ramah. And he stripped off his clothes and prophesied before Samuel in like manner, and lay down naked all that day and all that night. Wherefore they say, is Saul also among the prophets?" Let's just clear this up. This probably doesn't mean that he stripped off all of his clothes and was absolutely buck naked. What it's more likely referring to is that he's overwhelmed by the Holy Spirit, and so he totally casts aside all of his outer robes, those types of garments, like a king would wear. And he's sprawled without any real ability to control himself because he's prophesying, he's saying things, he's sprawled this way on the ground. Whether he's rolling around or not, I don't know. The word I want to use is humiliation. You want to go there? I have no interest. I mean, I know we're supposed to be humble. I'd rather work on it myself. I really don't need, but I don't want God having to take this kind of dealing with me. Someone has said, well, it's John MacArthur, if you're interested, made the observation in this instance that this is probably, other than two other things that happened in Saul's life, this is probably the most humiliating affair that we know anything about. The other two probably do supersede this in intensity, but then we're further down the road and it's getting worse and worse and worse. There's two other times that he's sprawled on the ground. Now, MacArthur didn't point that out, but this is interesting, that it matches up. There are two other times he's sprawled on the ground. One is in chapter 28 when he's there with the witch at Endor. He's eaten nothing. He realizes the end is imminent, and he's just, that's probably worse than this. And the last time is in chapter 31. He's sprawled on the ground again. He has no head. They've cut that off. And it won't be long before the Philistines come and collect the body and nail that to the wall in Bethshan. That's the ultimate humiliation. Probably no other scene. This is probably in intensity the worst, except for those other two. And it's very interesting, his position at the feet of Samuel, at the feet of these other prophets. Isn't that interesting? The man of God that he was spurning, the man of God that he was resisting. And there he is sprawled at his feet. And one cannot help but be reminded of the church at Philadelphia in Revelation chapter 3 and verse 9, where God says to them, "Behold, I will make them of the synagogue of Satan, who say they are Jews and are not, but do lie. Behold, I will make them to come and worship at thy feet and to know that I have loved thee." I'm telling you something, beloved, and here's the point that we'll have to quit with. God may be a God of love, and he certainly is. God is a God of compassion as well. But God is too big to fight. God is too strong to resist. And if you or I attempt to do that, we will find ourselves utterly broken and humiliated. You've heard the story. It seems like it has several renditions. I don't know. Maybe it's happened more than once. Maybe that's the reason. Sort of like Jesus talking to people on different occasions, and it sounded a lot alike, but there were small differences in the Gospels. There was a young man who went to a church to preach. He was all decked out. Must have been when three-piece suits were in style. He had his three-piece suit all decked out. He had a Bible as Tom McCracken. That thing's a suitcase, Tom. And he got up when it was time, and he climbed up to the sacred desk where the pulpit was, and he began to preach. And he didn't last 5 minutes before it just all came apart on him. I don't know what in the world, what his style was, he just got tongue-tied. He couldn't talk. He finally was so frustrated after 5 minutes of trying to present this sermon that undoubtedly he had polished and refined. He just walked down from the thing and sat down and just was dejected. There was an old brother in the church who was heard to say, "Well, if he had gone up like he came down, he would have come down like he went up." That's scary. I can tell you, as one who does it, that's scary. No one really wants to go there. No one wants to be humiliated. That's why it's really important when you're doing this kind of work, whether you're teaching a Sunday school class, playing the instrument. You know, that's why it's really important to know you're doing it for Jesus. You're not doing it to put yourself on display. You're doing it because God's people need ministered to. You're not doing it because you're God's greatest gift to the piano. Because if you approach it that way, I don't know how God is going to deal with you, but God does have the capacity to humiliate. And again, you have to understand, it isn't because God is unkind, unloving, or in some way hateful himself. No, it's just back to the message that I've been talking about all morning now. God's chastening is real, and God's chastening is frightful. Can I leave you with this thought? Do we have any doubt that God does deal with sin? Do we have any doubt of that? Why would we think that God, who proves himself again and again in the life of Saul, proves himself? Now, look at all the chances Saul had. So it's not like God just hammered him. He had chance after chance. Even in this chapter, he had four more. He doesn't respond to it. And I'm just saying to you, this is my message this morning. Chastening is real. Chastening is frightful. We cannot be in any doubt that God means business. He will deal with us. And if in some way God is pointing something specific out to you this morning, the simple solution is to stop resisting and start submitting. Whatever it is God wants, whatever it is God has, whatever He's speaking to you about. And I want to close with a quotation from F.B. Meyer, who says this, I think, so eloquently, because he really brings it back to the point that this is self-inflicted pain. So listen to these words and we'll close. This is the bitterest of all, to know that the suffering need not have been, that it has resulted from indiscretion and inconsistency, that it is the harvest of one's own sowing, that the vulture which feeds on the vitals is a nestling of one's own rearing. Ah me, this is pain. This is an inevitable nemesis in life, the laws of heart and home, of the soul and human life cannot be violated with impunity. Sin may be forgiven. The fire of penalty may be changed into the fire of trial. The love of God may seem nearer and dearer than ever, and yet there is this awful pressure of pain. The trembling heart, the failing eyes, and pining of soul, the harp on the willows, the refusal of the lip to sing the Lord's song. It could have been avoided. Your mom tried to tell you. Your dad tried to tell you. A friend that loves the Lord tried to tell you. The preacher tried to tell you. The youth pastor tried to tell you. Your husband tried to tell you. Your wife tried to tell you. The Holy Spirit, witnessing in your own heart, tried to tell you. Don't go there. Don't go there. Father, into your presence we come. In spite of the fact that we have seen that it is in fact a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God, we come with confidence, knowing you never make a mistake, knowing that you love us too much to be unkind. Knowing that at times when you have chastened us, you have brought us only closer to yourself through that. Knowing at other times, it hasn't necessarily been chastening, it's just been refining fire. And we don't always understand, Lord, and sometimes confuse the difference. But Father, if there are those here this morning that sense that God is speaking, oh Lord, help us to think of the snowball. The further it goes, the bigger it gets, the harder it is to stop. Help us to know that a day of reckoning is coming. Help us to know that if we truly are your child, you will work in our lives. You will chasten us. You will do what it takes to draw that sin to our attention and to bring us to a place of humble submission. May we simply surrender now. All to Jesus I surrender. All to Him I freely give. Please, Lord, help us. Help us in our difficulty. Help us in our pride. Help us in our hardness of heart to know that your forgiveness and your cleansing are sweet. Your joy restored is wonderful. Your peace brought again into our hearts passes all understanding. And work to help us lay down any sort of rebellion that may be in our lives, that we may know you and be close to you, and barriers may be removed, whether towards you or toward others. For these things we pray in Jesus' wonderful name.